joyful play,
purposeful work,
rugged outdoor living.
Our camps and conservation efforts
teach timeless skills
and kindle the spirit within.
Farm and wilderness.
Farm and wilderness.
Farm and wilderness.
Welcome, everyone, to the Farm and Wilderness podcast. My name is W. I am your host. And if you were just tuning in for the first time, welcome. If you've been with us for a while, also welcome. This episode is a little bit different than some of the others. And I realize I've been saying that a lot, actually, because each episode does have a little bit slightly different format and a slightly different target audience. Whereas a lot of our director interviews are really aimed at current and new and future families and campers. And some of our conversations with some of our staff are about the wonky behind the scenesness of Farm and Wilderness. This episode is in a class of episodes that really focus on sharing our practices with other educators in the space. I also think that even if you're not an educator, if you work in any kind of organization, which pretty much all of us do, I think you'll find something useful in this episode. This episode is based on a presentation that I have given at conferences before and is really about laying out what is the systematized way to make sure staff feel supported. If you heard last week's episode with our staff voices, many of them talked about this exact thing, that they felt supported by the higher ups, the leadership, whatever kind of word you want to use for that. This has been something I've been thinking about a lot. I was really interested in leadership going all the way back to high school. And for folks who know me, this next thing probably wouldn't surprise you, but it started back then when I was student council president. And it just carried with me as I've gone through all of these various organizations. I think what's important to think about coaching and support is that there are lots of resources out there that will tell you kind of the exact phrases or orientation of your mind, or really think about building relationships. And I am not saying it's not important to build a relationship. It absolutely is the basis, the foundation of any kind of support, and especially in organizations where they are in the business of relationships like schools and summer camps and things like that. What I am saying, though, is that just telling a leader or a staff to build relationships and get to know someone isn't actually coaching and isn't actually support in and of itself. And so I'm going to make a case to you today that you need systems to actually really support the folks that you are serving, and that summer camps have something to teach other organizations. Now, when I think about support in an organization, the first thing I want you to think about is a traditional org chart that you have boxes with arrows aligned connected to other boxes underneath, and it's clearly showing reporting relationships. Who's in power? They tend to be pyramid shaped, right? There's more people on the bottom, and as you go up each level of management or leadership, there are less and less folks until you get to the CEO, the main leader, and then maybe above them, a board, likely a board, depending on what organization or type of organization you're in. I think for camps and relationship-centered places, I'm going to use camps as like a stand-in for that, but I mean all schools, that is a useful thing for role clarity. But another way to think about support is actually in concentric circles. Concentric meaning circles inside of each other, almost like a Russian nesting doll, where in a camp setting, I think the center of that circle is campers, right? Campers having a great time, feeling safe, feeling supported, all of those things. And then there is a group of people that hold them. That's that next layer of the circle out. That is the counselors. And then you have another ring, another layer going out. That is your leadership or support holding those counselors. Then another ring, that's senior leadership. And then another ring and another ring. And these rings are almost almost like hugging the one underneath them, right? The idea that like they are holding the folks in the rings inside of them. And it's an orientation of the work that I introduced to staff as a way to think it's not just a management reporting relationship. It is a relationship of support. So let me make a case for why you need systems around supporting staff. It's not enough to say you do support staff. I need to be able to look at an organization and look at their policies and what are their rituals and protocols and see where are the systems built out that show, oh, this is actually important. It's like the phrase, if you want to know an organization's values, look at their budget. In some ways, if you want to know what an organization is serious about, look at their systems. My first reason is that I say the math isn't mathing. There's not enough time in the day for what folks typically see as support, which is the one-on-one, right? Now, for taking myself for an example, when I first came on, actually even before that, in my early years working for the director before me, there was a lot of staff who wanted one-on-ones. They wanted to talk to the director. Now, a one-on-one, if you're lucky, is maybe a half hour, but so many meetings default to an hour. So if you do the math, if you have a staff of 60, that is 60 hours of one-on-ones you need to do. Maybe you can get through 8 a day, but that's assuming you're doing almost nothing else. It's taking 7.5 days just to do a round of one-on-ones. That doesn't actually work. There's a place for one-on-ones, I think, when you are onboarding someone and maybe a midsummer check-in and maybe a post kind of check-in. But if you are just relying on one-on-ones, I'm not sure that's as efficient as teaching others to coach. So you create a system of coaching where it's not you, the director, you, the person on top, that is somehow holding every single person, all 60 people. You go back to those rings concept again, where you are coaching and supporting the folks who you directly manage, who in turn doing that for those who they manage, and in turn for those manage, all the way to the counselors supporting the campers. Finally, you have to do something like that because you can't be the bottleneck. Now, here's where young leaders will often get in trouble. They want to feel needed and loved and, oh my gosh, everyone is coming to me for everything. You end up being the bottleneck and making everything inefficient because if everyone's going to you, you're burning out, right? And folks are getting frustrated because they can't get the answers they need right away. The second reason I think you need systems of coaching is that it can feel like the needs are more. The needs are more intense, complex, and frequent, right? When we're thinking of summer staff, we are seeing an increase in anxiety, substance use and dependence on substances, and low resilience. We're also seeing this in schools too. It feels like the needs are more complex. There's outside commitments. Now that we're in a world of hybrid work, there are more summer staff who are coming who need to hold a job maybe during the summer in addition to the work they're doing with you, or they have telehealth visits. And generally, there's more and higher expectations of what a job should be to someone. And then lastly, the needs feel frequent. It feels like they're changing almost every day, or they just keep coming up. The third reason you need systems is that you want to long-term build your bench. You want to train leadership staff to do more so they can kind of take over for you, right? There are many, many reasons why you should train staff up. I'm not going to spend a ton of time, but more than anything else, the more you make them capable to handle more things, the less you become the bottleneck. The more your staff can handle, the less they become dependent on you and become the bottleneck, which saves you time. Go back to that first case I made where the math isn't mathy and you just don't have time to do one-on-ones with every single person. So you need systems to do this correctly and to support your staff and keep them for the long term. So I'm going over three concepts today on this episode that work together as a system. The first concept is some back pocket questions that you can teach when you are teaching how to coach others. The second is a protocol you can use to prioritize the staff or prioritize the support for staff. And lastly, how to create plans to help staff improve. So let's talk about coaching. Coaching, oh, there's so many books on coaching. I'm going to focus on one, and I promise I'm not getting any kind of like money for pitching this. But the book that has taught me the most about coaching and I have in turn used to coach others and train others to coach is a book called The Coaching Habit: Say Less, Ask More, and Change the Way You Lead Forever. It's a big title, but The Coaching Habit by Michael Stanier. Now, backing up slightly, what do we mean? What do I mean by coaching, right? In the way I'm using coaching as opposed to a one-on-one, when you're creating a system of coaching, you're creating a system where the feedback, the touch points with staff are quicker and more frequent, kind of on the go. Good coaching can happen in 10 minutes or less. And when you are going throughout the day, you don't have time for an hour one-on-one. You probably don't have time to stop for 5 to 10 minutes and coach someone through a problem. Second is that coaching should be daily and formal. It's rather than it's coaching time, right? You don't put on a hat. You don't have like your coaching space. Maybe you do, right? But it should be like you're walking down the path and a staff member says, I have a problem. Great. Let me coach you through it. And then lastly, you're coaching because ultimately you're going to help more people do the work that has impact and meaning because you are building them up to take care of their own problems. And in turn, to take for them to help build other people's up. It's just there's this chain that goes on as you go through the system. Now, here's the thing about leaders. And the book talks about this idea called the advice monster. When I describe the advice monster, I want you to think of is this you, right? So if you were a leader or a manager or you're aspiring to be a manager or a leader, I mentioned when I was talking about the math isn't mathing that you can feel good to be the bottleneck for everyone to come to you, right? You as a leader likely, or especially a young leader, have a habit of being the advice giver, the expert, the answer it, the solve it, the fix it person. New supervisors, this can be really validating. Wow, I have all the solutions and answers and people need to come to me to get all of that from me. That feels really good. But that's how you become the bottleneck and you're not building others because you're simply giving the thing that they need. I compare it to the phrase around like, teaching someone to fish versus giving them a fish. When you're the advice monster, you're giving them a fish and they're just going to come back for more, which cramps your time and they don't grow. So instead, coaching allows you and helps you to break this habit of the advice monster because it makes you not be the bottleneck. I keep talking about this. It grows the person you're coaching in front of you. And super important for leaders, when you coach, it actually buys you time because you don't always have to give the advice in that moment. Coaching actually helps you slow down. So there are 7 questions in the book. I'm only going to go over 3. These are the 3 questions you would teach the folks that you are teaching to coach. The very first question is super simple, super powerful when coaching. What's on your mind? What's on your mind? This question is your go-to starting place, and it gets the conversation going. It avoids the what the book calls the small talk tango. How are you doing today? How's your kids doing, right? And that could be a place for those. But if you only have 5 or 10 minutes, you can't spend 3 minutes small talking. If your response to that is, well, it builds a relationship. Yes, but you have 23 hours and 50 minutes left in the day to do that. You need to be efficient with your time for them and for you. What's on your mind is neither too open and broad, and it's not too narrow and confining, right? It's not an invitation to tell you anything or everything. It's really asking like, what is at top of mind? What matters most to you right now? And what's on your mind, if that is maybe too broad, right? When you're sitting down with someone and they're going all over the place, you can focus it even more with the 3 P's. What's on your mind about your projects? What's on your mind about your people, or what's on your mind about patterns you're seeing, projects, people, or patterns? Question 1, what is on your mind? The person answers, you go to your next question. And this question is super powerful. And I use it all the time. And folks are recognized when I do these coaching questions on them. Question 2 is, what else? That's it. 2 words, what else? Pause. They just spoke to you. Take a beat and then ask, what else? The magic of this question is in 3 pieces. 1 is you get more information. It actually allows you to dig in more. That first response to that what's on your mind is often probably surface and might not actually be the real issue at hand. 2 is that pause and asking what else is your way of reining in your own advice monster because it's building a habit in yourself to not immediately respond. It actually allows you, requires you to listen. And lastly, it buys you more time. Again, you might feel you need to respond right away, but your first thought might not be the right advice, especially if you haven't gotten to the actual issue. A few pro tips around what else that I've learned and the book has talked about. 1 is stay curious and genuine. Notice if you've stopped paying attention after you ask what else. 2, ask it more than 1 time. You're more likely to ask it too few times. And so do it 2, 3, 4 times to really get at the heart of the matter. Pro tip number three, recognize success. If you reach there is nothing else, congrats. You have finished this line of inquiry. Keep it rolling. Move on to the next thing. And then four, connect is the last one. Move on when it's time, right? If you were feeling kind of peak in the conversation or peak in what they are sharing with you, you can make a modification to what else. That is there anything else which invites closure? The third question is, how can I help? What I love about this one is that you are actually putting the onus, the responsibility on the other person to make a clear and direct request. What do they actually want from you? And they probably do know what they want from you. They might not be ready to say it yet, but they probably know. And it stops you from leaping in to save them. It's actually really useful. And you can kind of coach them on maybe them trying to figure out what they need help with. Another variation of this is, what do you want from me? Or what do you need from me? Now, an important caveat is that you have to be careful with your tone on this one. Especially if you say, what do you want from me? What do you want from me? What do you want from me? Right? All those tones convey things you probably don't want to convey in coaching. And then lastly, when someone says what they need from you, how are you going to respond? Your response might be, yes, great, I can do that for you. Or no, I can't do that for you. Or no, but I can do this instead for you. Or lastly, let me get back to you, right? Again, the advice monster kicks in when you're like, I need to solve this right now. So there's seven questions, but the three questions that I focus most and train people on is, one, what's on your mind? Two, what else? And three, how can I help? What's on your mind? That's your back pocket, jump right in, opening question to coaching. What else is your moment to pause and then keep listening? And how can I help is having them do the mental lifting. If you're interested in all seven of the questions, I highly recommend picking up the copy of The Coaching Habit. Again, I'm not pitching that because I get anything. I just think the book is pretty great. So you've set up coaching at your organization, at your camp, and you are finding that things are being solved. Folks are feeling better. They're feeling supported. But also you're realizing, oh, snap, lots of people need support. And even though we're doing all these other efficient systems, we still need to prioritize supports, right? You can't give the same level of coaching and support to all folks at all times, consistently or sustainably. It's just not possible. Again, the math doesn't math. You will absolutely have people on the bus, to use that metaphor, that book, who are running, who don't need a ton of support. And you'll have other folks who need a lot of support for a lot of different reasons. And you will absolutely burn yourself out trying to be everything for everyone. So sometimes, and this can be hard to hear or say, but sometimes you need to triage support. And by sometimes, I mean often, right? Who needs it most and who can you serve right now? At my camp, Timberlake, a few years back, we started doing a lost camper drill. And the idea was, hey, which campers are not being seen by our staff? They are lost to us and not making the connections they need to make. A couple years ago, I started playing around and prototyping the equivalent of a lost staff drill. Now, my waterfront head doesn't like that name because lost staff drill is a very specific, or lost camper drill also, are very specific, like lifeguarding things that you do. But for the sake of this, I'm still going to call it the lost staff drill. Now, what are the benefits of this? This is a systematized way to determine who to prioritize support and coaching to. And this drill does three things that are helpful. One is that this drill gathers various perspectives to generate more information and reduce potential bias. Now, it comes directly from some of the work in schools around discipline. And as you may or may not know, right, discipline is disproportionately affecting students of color in terms of like harshness and length and things like that. And for the folks who were implementing those consequences, there was some bias that came into play because of their own internal biases. And often it was just one person. And so by expanding like a dean team or who is making decisions around discipline, it is a way of kind of counteracting those biases. The second reason this drill is really helpful is that it's a really efficient use of time, especially if you have a large staff like mine or even bigger. And then lastly, trackable over time. It is giving you a data set that you can look at week to week and year to year in terms of how support is being given. All right, so what is the drill? Here's the basics of the lost staff drill. You will need to gather all your leadership staff or the pertinent supervisory staff in a private spot somewhere. Two, you will review each of your staff and assign them a score for how much support they need. And then three, you'll do a little bit of quick math and discuss the results with your team. We do this almost like rock, paper, scissors style, where you throw a hand signal when asked how much support does this person need. You either give them a one, a two, or a three, or a fist, right? So level one, one finger. You would throw this when thinking about a staff member. If they don't need much, if any, support and are generally doing fine, both professionally and personally. So this is low. You might throw two fingers or medium if they need some support and maybe it's just temporarily. Maybe they had something happen recently, or you see that they're in the early stages of burnout. Level three is the high. They need a high amount of support. Either there's something going on personally, or they're struggling to fulfill the professional requirements of the job. When I first ran this, I only had one, two, three, and I had a zero, and it kind of threw the averages. And instead, I implemented a fist. So a fist has no mathematical value when we talk about averaging. A fist is simply saying you don't have enough information to determine their level of need. And this is really important because different parts of an organization sometimes have blindness to what's going on in other parts of the organization. So if you were leading the kitchen, you might not have any idea how the guy at the waterfront is doing. So a fist lets you acknowledge that lack of information rather than messing with the average by making a guess. Now, a few things about the hand signals, the things we throw when we're in the room saying, how much support does this person need? The score you give is just a snapshot in time, and it is a gut check. How are they doing right now? When someone's throwing those out or when you're throwing them out, if you're in doubt for how much support, you should round up or use the fist. You're assuming more support is needed. So if you're not sure if it's a one or two, throw a two. A really important point, and took some staff some time to get used to, is that we're not grading someone on performance or effectiveness. We are not saying they're a level one, two, three in terms of greatness for a staff member, because great staff can sometimes also need support. This is simply saying we need to support, we need to help this person. Lastly, and I haven't said it yet, but this whole thing requires confidentiality. The discussion cannot leave the room, which is why the folks you choose need to be your leadership and management staff. So here's how to run the protocol, right? We've gone over, you gather your staff and there is a way of scoring folks. Here's how you actually do it. So you are going to gather the folks, the leadership team in the room, and you need a list of your staff. You're not going to run the protocol on the people in the room. You're going to assign two roles. Someone needs to be the facilitator. And someone needs to be the note taker. The facilitator is actually telling people when to throw out their numbers, and the note taker is the one who's doing a quick scan who threw what. So facilitator will count down from three, and everyone in the group throws out a one, two, or three, or a fist at the same time. This is where it's like rock, paper, scissors. Three, two, one, go. And at the go, one, two, three, or fist. The note taker does a quick scan, writes down each person's response. And what's important is that they're not tracking who responded with what. They're simply tracking there were three people who said one, two people who said two, four fists, whatever it might be. You're going to do this for each of the staff on your list. At the end, you're going to have someone start doing the math. And while they're doing the math, you're going to do a very quick debrief with the folks. Now, this debrief is not about talking about people that you've scored yet. You use just two questions. These are my favorite go-to debrief questions. What did you notice? And what did you wonder? I use these as a teacher. And this quick debrief helps process the lingering emotions that might exist from, oh, I just graded someone, especially as a new supervisor. Now, how do you run the grading process? There are four ways that we analyze the data: averaging the score, noticing when there's a low level of agreement, who has the most number of fists, and which folks have outliers. So the average score is the most straightforward. You add up all the numbers and divide by the number of scores. You don't include the fist in the score, and the average is just a good place to start. Who are your top three highest scoring individuals in terms of averages who need the most support? The second one is a low level of agreement. You're looking through the scores and finding an individual who have very variable scores, right? They have ones, twos, and threes. And this is important because this helps you identify staff that your leadership team is seeing in very different lights. So you're going to analyze, why are you saying a three and you're saying a one? Are there some biases at play? Do you have information the rest of us don't? What's going on? The third is to count who has the most number of fists, right? You find the individuals who have the most Fs on the chart or whatever. And this helps you identify staff. This is where the lost drill comes in, the lost part of the lost drill, because this is identifying staff that are the most invisible to your leadership team, because that can be a problem. Lastly, you're finding folks with outliers. These are individuals similar to the low level of agreement, but these are the folks who generally have agreement on how they're doing with like one or two outliers. So a person might have all ones, but a three is thrown in there. Okay, what's going on? Again, are different levels of information in your leadership staff? What is going on? You run this protocol maybe every week, right? As you increase the frequency of the protocol, you increase its effectiveness because you're seeing over time, right? This person had a bunch of ones, now they're a bunch of threes. Or this person had a bunch of threes, now they're a one. It's a really, really simple protocol. It's really effective in terms of time and gives you a lot of data that you can track and respond to. So at this point, we've covered creating a culture of coaching using specific questions. We've reviewed a tool you can use to determine who needs support and how do you triage that. This last tool is kind of, okay, you've done those things and now you need to support someone. What do you do? And this next piece is one that can certainly get a really bad rap depending on kind of the underlying reasoning or culture around it. And I'm talking about the equivalent of a behavior improvement plan or a performance improvement plan, like a PIP or a BIP. And these can be kind of scary because they're so often associated with this is the step a company is going to do before they fire you. So they're just trying to get their paperwork together. And when I use it in conjunction with these other two systems, it's not that. It's actually a way of communicating with a ton of transparency. What exactly is the issue and how leadership and staff are going to support someone? So this coaching plan, this kind of staff improvement plan, has three steps. First step is you're going to identify the specific behaviors that need to change or the supports that need to be provided to that staff member. Second is you write the plan with a timeline and be super specific. And lastly, you assign a champion, a staff member who will check in frequently with that person and like works the plan with them, provides them the supports. So I'm going to go over each of those. Let's talk about that first part, the identifying the specific behaviors. Now, this comes directly from my kind of work in special education, working with students for a long time. And when you are developing a plan for a staff member who needs support, there are three parts of that plan. There is the precipitating behaviors, the intervention, and the potential additional consequences. So that precipitating behavior is where you start and is where you are writing with detail and minimal commentary. No like extra thoughts or feels or like loaded verbs, minimal commentary about what the particular behaviors that were going on that caused the coaching plan to be put in place in the first place. Right? This is someone who is constantly showing up late or is not following directions or is seen, you know, really kind of sad and not able to do their job. Something. There's some behavior that got to this point. The second part of the plan is the intervention. This is, again, with detail, minimal commentary. What will the staff member need to be successful? here's what you need to do instead, and what will the camp do to support that staff member? So the intervention is important because you're setting the high expectations and providing the high level of support that might be needed to meet those expectations. Lastly, this is where it can feel kind of icky or not, depending on kind of your culture and what you're thinking. But lastly is like the potential additional consequences. Again, with detail and minimal commentary, what additional steps might be taken if the staff member doesn't follow through on the plan, right? So we've identified, here are the behaviors that you need to work on. Here's how we're going to help you, and here's what you need to do instead. And if you choose not to do this or can't do this, here's what's going to happen. Now, a note on consequences. Consequences are not always bad. We often use it to mean punishment. Consequences are simply what results from the specific behavior. And a consequence could be a positive or negative reinforcer of that behavior. So that last part, the potential additional consequences, might be a negative reinforcer. If you don't do this, this will happen. Or a positive reinforcer, when you complete this plan, this is going to happen. So I want to give you two examples of what coaching plans could look like. So for this first example, I'm going to give you the precipitating behaviors, the intervention, and the potential additional consequences. The behaviors are: the staff member has expressed frustration and feeling overwhelmed with their cabin and two specific campers. They feel under-supported and like they don't have the skills needed. Great, we've identified they need a plan. Here's what the intervention would be in this plan. Their supervisor or their champion will meet with the staff member over 3 afternoons to make a plan. The supervisor or the champion will check in every morning and night, and the supervisor will review the basic hierarchy of intervention that we use for behavior management and cabin routines. And here, the last part's important. This will last for 5 days. This is not an open-ended, it's going to happen forever. We're going to give you intense support for 5 days. And if at the end of the 5 days, here's the potential additional consequences, if a staff member still feels unsupported at the end, we'll do one of the three things: consider revising this plan, provide more frequent check-ins, or possibly move that staff member to another part of camp. So we have the behaviors, the intervention, and the consequences. Another example might be a staff member who is late to multiple shifts. They show public disrespect towards their supervisor, excessive cursing during work hours, and then inappropriate use of technology during the day. Our intervention is going to look different for these behaviors. So it might be, okay, you need to show up to all shifts on time or even early. You need to treat all staff, including your supervisor, with respect, which means, and this is important, with respect, you got to be real clear what you mean. So for us, what this means is watching your words and your tone, not rolling your eyes or displaying any other behaviors that could be interpreted as disrespectful. No cursing during work hours. And you need to follow all directions from your shift leaders, your manager, quickly, correctly, and the first time. And if there is a question about that directive, you'll ask that person about it. And this plan will last for 5 days. Now, the potential additional consequences are real straightforward. And this particular staff member that had this plan a few years ago was under 18. The potential additional consequence at the time was, we're going to call your mom, which you don't always have that option. And then lastly, termination. Basically, like, if you can't get it together, this is not going to work out for us. So being in both of those examples, being very clear, what triggered this? What do you need to do? And what are we going to do to support you? And what might happen? So as we wrap up, we've talked about three concepts that work together. There's the coaching, the back pocket questions that you can teach your leadership and management staff, these simple questions and concepts that you can focus on and reinforce, combined with a way to prioritize support for your staff, the protocol you can use, the lost staff protocol, with leadership to prioritize struggling staff. Then lastly, creating plans to improve staff, the staff improvement plan, performance improvement plan, whatever you want to call it. And it's a simple 3-part plan that you and your leadership can use to help staff get back on track. I hope you found this helpful. I hope there is some little something that you will be able to use and implement to improve your own organization. More episodes coming in the next few weeks, some more interviews, another couple of these, sharing best practices, and some looking towards celebrating our 85th summer this year. you'd like to register, apply for a job at, or just learn more, check out farmandwilderness.org. We're on YouTube, we're on Instagram, and we're on TikTok, where we feature staff testimonials. Original music by Emmett Powers, recording and editing done by myself. Thanks to everyone at Farm and Wilderness who helped make our summers possible. And with that, remember, camp magic is real, y'all. Until next time.